tune Saturday night. You know, best behavior, you see it? Because I will be there, you see it? Leaving you with this one.
See,
an old school classic.
Get out of here.
www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web.
When they hang my husband, is that just?
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia, and I'm your host for today's show. Today you will be hearing from Matthew, who is currently incarcerated at Riviere de Prairie Prison on the island of Montreal. He shares news with us about the situation in RDP 2 years into the COVID-19 pandemic. After that, we will hear from authors of the book Disarm, Defund, Dismantle, Police Abolition in Canada, which just came out with Between the Lines Press. Editor Abby Stadnick and authors of the chapter called Defund to Abolish spoke to us about what's in the book, what it was like to write it, and why they think you should read it. But first, here's some words from Matthew, who is currently incarcerated at Riviere de Prairie Prison on the island of Montreal.
Today I'm just calling because I want to, like, you know, put it in the air that the conditions of the jail are not the greatest. You know, there's always a shortage of staff. Guys are locked up, like, most of the day, you know. Like, basically, even right up until now, guys haven't been out since yesterday. They went in yesterday at, like, 10:30, and they're still in their cells. And we're going on, like, 4:30 or 5 o'clock. And, you know, I just want to, like, get it out there that a lot of the conditions of the jail are really not good. They give us the bare minimum when it comes to, you know, hygiene or cleaning products. You know, there's also a lot of stuff going on in the jail that, like, you know, they seem to, like, turn a blind eye to. Like, you know, like, the bad people get away with the bad stuff, you know, and the good people, they're always the ones end up paying the price. Like I'm currently doing right now, you know, I'm currently doing 22 hours a day of deadlock. It's been like that since right now. It's been since the 28th of March, only because I refuse to go in a certain sectors or whatever, and they're saying that, you know, I have to accept that classification. If not, I have to go in a protection setting or remain on a regime C, which I refuse the protection and I refuse the classification, so I'm on a regime C. I want to start, you know, talking and getting the message out there, you know, because I'm hoping for the youth, you know, that, you know, someone could pick up along the way and understand that, you know, I don't want to see no youth, you know, the youth grow up coming through these conditions, you know, and going through this, and I want to let people know, you know, how much of a terrible place it is, you know. Not so much the staff, like, you know, okay, yeah, we call them screws, you know, because they're the nuts and the bolts that keep this place running, but humans are the only creature that lock up their own kind, you know, and I'm still trying to figure that one out. Since I've been in here since May 2020, and I've done 10 quarantines, and I'm hoping that this will count for double time, you know, because it took away the double time. It took away a lot of other things, too, a lot of other privileges. I just want people to know, like, within the, like, last 4 months, I only been out in the yard one time. I've never been offered to go out in the yard except for the other day. Like I said, even the food, like, look, okay, for example, yesterday they gave us chicken. The chicken, everybody knows, is not properly cooked. I'm locked up. I'm left to eat this raw chicken, which I didn't. So I basically went without being fed yesterday. And I don't have canteen, so, you know, it's not like I could just put, like, eat some chips and put some snacks together, you know? You know, the tap water is no good. You know, we don't get any juice. We don't get no fruits. You know, you got 70-year-old men coming, like, to jail for I don't know what reasons. but you got them sleeping on the floor because of the bombardment of the place is like, you know, it's full. I want to get the word out there so that hopefully, you know, we could pile up on this, you know, and probably make some claims, you know, or some petitions, you know, about the way that the prison system is treating us, you know. This is inhumane. And the fact that since about January 1st, I have almost all my records of all the days and hours and the times that have been locked down. You know, I just want to expose the jail in that sense, you know. It took me, I was writing memos to go see the doctor since the 8th of October. I was just recently met by a doctor like maybe a week and a half ago. You know, by that time, my symptoms had either doubled or worsened. You know, most of my memos that I've written, you know, I got to keep my copy, and that copy goes to the jail. Maybe like 80% of the memos that I sent out, I never got an answer for since I've been here. I've been here since May 2020. But the conditions of the jail themselves are not good, especially when guys are, you know, entitled to have their certain amount of freedom, their certain amount of privileges that are being stripped away from us day by day. And, you know, nobody knows in what direction to go to try to, you know, to try to stop this or try to prevent this from happening, you know? Like, if they have a shortage of staff, then they may as well find a place to put the prisoners and close down the jail. Also, that what I wanted to mention was that, you know, in the beginning, you know, they were making guys do 14 days from the moment they come, like, to the jail, and now they don't do it no more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the guys come in, they do, like, one day quarantine, and then they just let them on the loose. And how many times do we have to go through this where guys come in and then they shut down all the sector and we end up paying the cost because they're not properly doing what they should be doing, you know? I don't know about the measures that are going on outside. And there's a lot more that I have to say, you know? I'm a little, like, shy. I'm a little nervous, you know, speaking, you know? I'm not really an open speaker, but I'm going to start calling more, you know, to make more mention, you know, and I'm going to encourage more people to call, and I hope that this call, you know, encourages people to call or to voice, you know, their opinion and to speak up. And also, you know, hopefully someone outside is listening and, you know, they know what it is and they've been there and they could, you know, start, you know, advocating for us in the same way that I'm trying to do, and that in the same way that CKUT and you guys are trying to help, you know, and big up CKUT 90.3 FM and, you know, all the staff and all the shows that play, and yeah, big up CKUT, you know, big up Montreal 514, and this is Matthew, and that is just my message, you know, that I want to get out there.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. That was Matthew, who is currently incarcerated at Riviere de Prairie Prison. A reminder that anyone in prison on the island of Montreal, that is in Bordeaux Prison or in RDP, can call us collect at 514-876-3748, and we will do our best to answer. For those listening, we do not have paid staff working on the show. We're all volunteers, so we answer the phones when we can. Up next is our interview with Abby Stadnick, Ted Rutland, and Sandra Wesley, who all participated in writing the book Disarm, Defund, Dismantle, Police Abolition in Canada. We recorded this interview on April 4th, 2022. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And this book looks really exciting. And I wondered if you could all start first by introducing yourselves as individuals and tell us a bit about the groups that you're in.
My name is Abby Stadnick. I'm a settler writer, someone who's been involved in prison abolition primarily, although through the course of doing that work have come to understand the inseparability of prison and police abolition as part of the need to dismantle the larger penal system. I'm involved in this project, in this book project, Disarm, Defund, Dismantle, Police Abolition in Canada, as an editor along with Shiri Pasternak and Kevin Walby. Although our editor role, I mean, really, I think, I don't want to speak for them, but I think in our conversations, we have sort of agreed that our role is sort of more on the administrative side and to sort of assist in putting together the book and amplifying the amazing work that the contributors have done. Really, there's a fantastic array of contributors from across so-called Canada. As an individual, I'm also involved in Freelance Free Peoples. Freelance Free Peoples has a chapter in the book. That collective is an Indigenous-led anti-colonial abolition group. I'm also, as an individual, involved in SMAC, which is the Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Alberta Abolition Coalition, which is a Prairie Province coalition of abolitionist organizers, including Freelance Free Peoples. And as an individual, I have also done work with incarcerated people, primarily through teaching writing classes on the inside in a volunteer capacity.
Yes, hi. I'm Sandra Wesley. I am a member of the Montreal Defund the Police Coalition. I'm also the executive director of Stella Lamy de Mamie, which is an organization by and for sex workers. And I'm involved in various other initiatives, primarily in the HIV movement, which has a long history of being an anti-carceral movement, and in the feminist movement, which has a more mixed history of not always being very critical of the carceral system. And so I've been working for many years in various capacities as someone who has experienced incarceration, who has experienced criminalization, and who thinks that actions to defund the police are a really central element to bring together many different struggles that I personally face and that my communities face.
So I'm Ted Rutland. I'm a teacher and writer. I do a lot of teaching, writing, and activism around policing and prison injustices through an abolitionist frame. I'm a member of Anti-Carceral Group, which is a collective based in so-called Montreal that does a lot of popular education around prison rights and prison abolition, as well as organized protests and various other kinds of actions in solidarity with people imprisoned in this area. And I'm a member of the Defund the Police Coalition with Sandra. And Sandra and I, with input from the rest of the Defund the Police Coalition, co-wrote a chapter that appears in this excellent book.
Yeah, so I wanted to start with the chapter from you guys, Ted and Sandra, and from Defund Montreal, Defund the Police Montreal. So the chapter is called Defund to Abolish, a 400-year history of police in Montreal. Can you two talk more about it and tell us some of the basic outline of the points you guys are making across there? And just to say, like, 400 years is a lot of history to cover, so I'm also curious to hear about, like, what you decided to include and what you couldn't include.
So, yeah, I guess we see policing as something that pre-exists police departments. And so, you know, when French settlers came to this area, they defined the indigenous people as un peuple sans police. And they didn't mean police departments, because there wasn't such thing as a police department in the 1600s, really anywhere in the world. But it shows the way in which the sort of antecedents to the police were integral to the colonial project. And so we try to start our history of policing really with settler colonialism, with the dispossession of indigenous people, with the enslavement of both indigenous and African descended people, and the deeply hierarchical social order that was built even among settlers on this land. And so we try to talk about, you know, the way that laws were codified, the way that surveillance was instituted, in the 1600s and 1700s, before there was a police department, which included, obviously, you know, sets of rules around the consumption of alcohol, the policing of public space, which had, you know, detrimental impacts to anyone who wasn't part of the elite. There's a tendency to see working class or poor women in public as sex workers and police them as such. You have, you know, prohibitions against serving alcohol to indigenous people, African people, or indentured white people. And then you have, you know, indigenous people getting pushed off the island of Montreal entirely in the 1720s. You have the ways in which everyday white people were called on to keep enslaved African people under surveillance. And so a whole regime of, you know, racist and classist and patriarchal policing is installed right away and kind of provides the framework within which, you know, a formal police department is eventually developed. And I guess the other thing I'll say before passing off to Sandra is that policing and the police department have been resisted throughout that history. You know, only parts of that history can really be told, because a lot of that resistance, didn't take the form of organized protests that got reported on in the archives or newspapers. It includes, you know, the refusal of Indigenous people to cede their land fully, despite the intentions of the settler state. It includes the efforts of African people to be free, despite their status as slaves. But then there's a history of really formal, invisible activism against the police that we can start to see around the 1960s, and we try to trace a little bit of that history, and primarily, I think, to show that, you know, those sort of formal political actions, those formal protests, which have demands, have often demanded a set of reforms that don't really do very much, if anything, to change policing. And so it's important to note that, because many of those same demands are being made today, and they didn't do anything when they were implemented in the past, and they're not going to do anything today. But there's actually a visible history of demands that look a lot like what the Defund the Police Coalition is demanding, including, you know, having police pull out of certain neighborhoods and have communities take care of safety, including, you know, is something that we're not really demanding as a coalition, but really, really a discipline system that would actually ensure that there are consequences for police officers who harm people. That's not one of our demands, but it is this demand that's sort of hung in the air for decades and nothing really gets done about it. And so just trying to show that this didn't come out of nowhere, you know, sometimes people like to say that, you know, the Black Lives Matter uprising in 2020 kind of invented defund the police and invented police abolition. But we know that that's not true. And you can see that earlier history in Montreal as well.
Thank you, Ted. I agree with all of that. And I think one of the big reactions that we initially got with the coalition was that response that police abolition or defunding the police were new ideas, and that they were somehow imported from the United States. That was a common reaction that we got from politicians and journalists and other people that were engaging with us. So we thought it was important to highlight the fact that it's actually not new. A year before we started this coalition, I was personally at the pre-budget consultation at the city, asking for a reduction in the police budget, and I was pretty much laughed out of the room. But those are demands that so many groups have been making for a very long time. And sometimes it's not always phrased as defund the police. We phrase it in many other ways. And what we get when we come together under this banner and this idea of defunding the police is that we get groups that don't necessarily always work together at the same table, and we get to make a demand that is cohesive. For example, I'm involved in a lot of communities where we're demanding to reform the law, to actually abolish a lot of criminal laws. So when we're asking to decriminalize drugs, or we're asking to decriminalize homelessness, what we're asking is to take away the mandate of police to surveil, harass, and arrest our communities. And obviously, this means taking away money from them. We're not going to have as many police officers applying fewer laws. It just makes no sense. But we don't always phrase it when we're talking about decriminalization. We don't always phrase it as defunding the police. But when we come together with this idea, then we get to express our ideas in a way that is a little bit different. Same thing for communities that are asking for investment in the community. Those are demands that have been around forever. But to frame it as there actually is money in the municipal budget, we can take it from the police and give it to those communities, then that's a new way of expressing old ideas that have been around for a long time. So I think in our chapter, we wanted to highlight that element of history, that it's not new, that police have always been racist also, that police have always been discriminatory, It's not just a side effect of policing, but it's built in to what police is about. And also maybe encourage people to think about the fact that we didn't always have police forces the way we have now, that maybe there are alternatives that exist, that it's not just a fact of life that police has to look the way it looks now. And then we wanted to just encourage people to reflect on what it could mean for them, for their own communities, to defund the police, because ultimately that's how we get people to rally around the cause once they realize the amazing things that could happen if we were to actually put this plan in place, and the transformations that we can see in society. We're so used to just bargaining for the smallest little change that sometimes even as activists, we're not used anymore to taking a step back and actually dreaming about the real things that we do want. And I think that when we talk about defunding the police, it opens up that possibility in a very motivating way.
I was wondering if you two could talk a bit more. So the chapter's called Defund to Abolish, and definitely, it's super interesting to hear you all talk about how you wanted to extend people's understanding of the history of the idea of defunding the police. But I also saw in the aftermath of the George Floyd uprising in the U.S. that, you know, people would sometimes talk about defund and talk about abolish as if they were like two different things, like two different demands to be making. And some people are calling for defund and some people are calling for abolition. And I just think it's interesting. Your chapter is called Defund to Abolish. And I wanted to get you guys to talk a little bit more about, you know, what seems to be a bit of a strategy of a, like, you know, we're asking for defunding in order to abolish. And if you guys could lay that argument out a little bit more.
Yes, absolutely. It's very easy whenever we have very smart ideas for policy change to want to build the biggest possible coalition and to start minimizing some of our motivations and make compromises that end up diluting our message. And I think defunding the police is one of those things that has that risk, because like a lot of other very progressive policies, there's a conservative argument that could be made for defunding the police. Defunding the police could come in all kinds of ways that are problematic and not really in line with our values. So it's important for us as a coalition to acknowledge that we're getting together and we're accepting membership and solidarity from anyone who agrees with our current demands of defunding at least half of the police budget and all of the other demands that we lay out, but that the values that we're drawing from and the goal that we're striving for is an abolitionist goal. We don't want to shy away from it. We don't want to hide it or pretend that that's not the goal, because it's only when we keep that objective in mind that if we do have the opportunity to actually put in place those policies, that we can do it in a way that doesn't end up harming people or that doesn't end up causing unintended negative consequences or actually losing the idea of really centering the people that are most affected by criminalization and policing.
Abby, I wanted to turn back to you. You mentioned that you had worked on the introduction to the book and that you're also a part of Freelance Free Peoples, who wrote a chapter in the book called A Brief Introduction to Anti-Colonial Abolition. Do you want to talk a bit more about that chapter, and then maybe we can zoom back out and talk about the project as a whole?
The chapter, A Brief Introduction to Anti-Colonial Abolition, was written by the Freelance Free Peoples Collective, which is three of us, two Indigenous women and myself, like I said before, a white settler. And we talk about sort of the long pre-existing history of Indigenous justice traditions on these lands. So we're located specifically in Miskwichi, which is the Cree word for what is also known in the colonial context as Edmonton, Alberta, and we're thinking specifically about a prairie context, and so drawing on Cree and, or Nehiyaw and Métis laws and justice traditions, specifically thinking about laws such as the Law of Wet'suwet'en, which, you know, is very more complex than I understand, of course, and certainly more complex than I can explain here, but to give a brief overview, it has to do with our interrelatedness with everything, our interrelatedness and our kinship with everything, including, you know, other people, as well as more than human beings and the land, the air, and the waters. And so Cree and Métis, or Nehiyaw and Métis, laws that emphasize the importance of our interrelatedness, understand justice in terms of mending and preserving those relationships and relational accountability and our responsibilities to each other. So we start the chapter by talking, of course, about the fact that these laws and justice traditions pre-exist the imposition of settler colonial law, which is, of course, quite different in terms of its punitive aspect, in terms of the way that it tries to separate, to segregate, to dismantle community and relationality, to remove people from their lands, from their relationships and responsibilities to their lands and their nations, their communities, and families. So we talk about the imposition of that foreign system as a settler colonial system. We point towards scholars that people can look at if they're interested in understanding more about Indigenous laws and justice traditions. And then we sort of move into talking about, again, the imposition of the settler colonial justice system, first in terms of policing and then in terms of prisons, similar to what my colleagues were speaking of in terms of the long history. We talk about, you know, policing on the prairies and elsewhere in the country, but policing on the prairies through the RCMP, formerly the Northwest Mounted Police, always being targeted or intended to police and control, contain, and displace and remove Indigenous peoples from their land. So looking at that long history stretching back into the 19th century. With settlement, RCMP were always about removing Indigenous people to clear the way for white settlement and police continue to protect white property interests in the way that space is policed currently. So we look at that, and then we move to thinking about prisons and the way that prisons also, again, function to remove Indigenous peoples from their lands. And there's a common way of thinking about prison. Well, I think it's common anyway. It was mentioned in the Maclean's magazine, so that in 2015, I think, of prisons as the new residential schools. So I think that's become quite a common discourse. But in the paper, in the chapter, we dig down a little bit deeper into that idea to think through how prisons and residential schools as carceral institutions have always been intertwined back in the 19th century when following the wars on the plains in the States, Colonel Pratt took plains Indian warriors, removed them from their territories on the plains, transported them to Fort Marion in Florida, incarcerated them there, and instituted sort of a assimilationist regime of so-called education and quote-unquote civilization. And that same colonel then, Colonel Pratt, became the notorious sort of founder of one of the first residential schools called boarding schools in the States, Carlisle Industrial Boarding School. And so we can see that what he did in the prison system there at Fort Marion and the way that he attempted to quote-unquote civilize the Indigenous men incarcerated there was then transplanted into how he was thinking about, again, quote-unquote civilizing Indigenous children. So we talk a little bit about that history and the carceral continuum of those two institutions. And then the last section of the chapter, we turn to talking about Indigenous justice in practice currently, and that Indigenous resistance, of course, has been in place since contact and continues on. And so to think about Indigenous justice in terms of the many movements of Indigenous people, such as Idle No More, Land Back, actions like road blockades, the stopping of railway distribution of goods, encampments that care for Indigenous communities, et cetera, that those are not simply protests that oppose the state, but that they're embodiments of Indigenous justice and relational accountability. Those Indigenous laws that I was speaking of earlier, that those actions are embodiments of Indigenous law and practice.
It sounds like there's a bunch of amazing history in both of these chapters. I'm wondering if you all can talk about, I think, Sandra, you touched on this a little bit already, but I'd love for you guys to all talk about it a bit more. But can you all talk about the context that led you to want to create a book like this? Are there specific things that were happening around you all that made you think that, you know, the world really needs a book like this?
I think it had to do with the moment, the political moment that that we found ourselves in following the police murder of George Floyd, and the way that, I think Ted was speaking of this earlier, or maybe Sandra, but the way that in Canada there tends to be sort of a distancing that happens amongst the general public, thinking that sort of the kind of inherent racism and violence of the police in the States doesn't apply here. And, you know, of course it does. It is, I think Sandra was saying, you know, it's built into policing as a structure. And so in that moment, following the murder of George Floyd, and then there was a succession of police murders of Indigenous and Black and other people of color in Canada as well, I think there was a turn towards understanding the need to highlight, to sort of step away from that Canadian exceptionalism or what have you, and to highlight the fact that policing is a violent institution that wreaks incredible harm on communities in Canada as well. And so I do think that this is the first collection of its kind that looks at activist and scholarly perspectives on police abolition in Canada specifically. So I think it's doing important work in that sense, and comes out of that political moment, but also the moment, I think, of COVID, and the way that the pandemic has amplified and underscored existing and longstanding inequities and injustices. So I think, I mean, in my context, or sort of in the context of the work that I do, that was particularly visible in terms of what was happening in prisons, and the way that, you know, although there was some decarceration of folks initially in the pandemic, we were hearing about all of the horrific conditions inside, the inability, of course, to physically distance inside, the lack of PPE, the, you know, the unsanitary and unhygienic conditions inside. And so those, you know, those are not exceptional moments, but they highlight that in prisons, that sort of lethal force of prisons was, I guess, highlighted in the moment of COVID. And I think the moment of COVID also did that in other, highlighted other inequities in other contexts. So I think that was part of the political kind of impetus. Those two things, kind of the uprising, the movement for Black lives, the understanding of the Canadian context, and COVID, that sort of all came together to shape the need for this sort of book. I think, though, in terms of the practicality of it, I think Kevin Walby, one of the editors, sort of assembled a number of people and reached out and asked folks if they wanted to contribute, and then it just rolled out from there.
Ted and Sandra, I don't know if either of you have possibly more personal or possibly more specific to Defund the Police Montreal that you want to add in terms of the context that led you all to want to participate in the creation of this book.
Well, I think that for me, as a community activist who doesn't like to engage a lot with academia or with publication in general, I always appreciate when people take the initiative of putting these things together, because ultimately they do serve a purpose and they are helpful. Putting together a collection of those texts is actually a very useful way to document what we're doing right now, to highlight who's doing that community work that often is invisible in history. So I think it was very important to participate, and it's always very interesting to see what actually comes together in those types of books. And in this one, I was so pleasantly surprised as a sex worker myself to see so many sex worker voices highlighted in the book, because we, you know, we have been very active in the anti-carceral and prison abolition and anti-criminal movements, but we're often excluded or not necessarily highlighted. So it was very it was very good to see that there was that ability to mobilize us into participating in this book, even though we're often very, very, we're not necessarily the most eager to participate in those kinds of projects. But now that we have it and that we see it all together, then it's very much worth it.
One of the things that I think is really useful about the book and why I was really excited that it was going to exist and then that we'd get to contribute to it is that struggles against the police are often very local, where many of the police departments that we're fighting against are city-specific departments, or, you know, it's the Sûreté du Québec or RCMP, but even then the RCMP plays a much different role in some communities than it does in others. And so this was a chance to, you know, share what we're doing and learn from each other, because this has to be, you know, more than a city-specific struggle. I don't think we're going to abolish the police in Montreal if there isn't a movement in other cities doing the same kind of thing. And of course, you know, I say that these are local struggles, but the police have linkages across so-called Turtle Island around the world. They're meeting constantly and sharing information on how to fight against us, how to, you know, circulate narratives that are going to make it seem like we really need the police when the public is starting to understand that we don't. And so if we're not organizing, you know, across these vast geographies, I don't think we're going to do very well. So I'm, you know, I really appreciate the book for that reason.
Both of those comments really made me think about a few other ideas, which is sort of the idea of the movement. I don't know if before 2020 people in so-called Canada would have talked about or described the, you know, defund and abolition movement as such. I don't know. I mean, from my perspective, perhaps not. I think there has been, like Ted's saying, this real sort of coming together across a vast land known as Canada to collaborate. There have been a number of sort of collectives and coalitions. I mean, I was mentioning SMAC before, which is prairie specific, but then there have been ones at the level of Canada that have come together to, like Ted was saying, share resources, share information. There's a great website, noprisons.ca, that has a bunch of sort of introductory material on abolition, sort of abolition 101 type material. So I think there's been sort of a consolidation and development of a movement that I hadn't seen before, at least as someone situated in the prairies. I mean, the prairies to me feels very isolated in a lot of ways from what's going on in abolitionist organizing across the country. There's a lot of strength in abolitionist organizing out east, and then also on the west coast. The prairies, not as much, and certainly not under the sort of banner of abolition, but I think this has been a good sort of opportunity and moment for us to come together.
Yeah, all I was going to add to what you were saying, Ted, was that in addition to different police forces around the world, like backing each other up and having conferences and strategizing, et cetera, the same is true with the prison system. CSC participates in like an international coalition of different prison systems that get together every year and have a conference and swap tips and, you know, share contractors that they work with and all of that kind of stuff. So it's like a very, they're very coordinated. So we need to be very coordinated too kind of situation.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. You're in the middle of hearing an interview with the authors of Disarm, Defund, Dismantle, Police Abolition in Canada, a book that was recently released with Between the Lines Press.
Sandra, just to build on what you were saying about some of the other chapters that you were excited about that were written by and were talking about the struggles of sex workers, I wondered if you all could talk about other chapters in the book that you're excited about that maybe you didn't necessarily contribute to, but that you hope that listeners will check out if they get their hands on the book.
Yes. So the ones I was mentioning earlier are specifically the ones written by my colleagues from Maggie's and from Sex Workers of Winnipeg. And also the chapter by Elaine Lam and Chanel, get her last name, sorry, about migrant sex workers. I think that altogether, that really presents a very interesting view of the place that sex workers have been taking in movements against prison and against police. And it shows different perspectives, different actions.
I am very excited about all those chapters as well. To add a couple others that appeal to, you know, personal interests of mine, I suppose, there's a chapter by Shiri Pasternak called Canada is Bad Company, where she's kind of questioning this idea that the police only collaborate with corporations in particular moments or particular times. And I mean, we can make the parallel there with, you know, people who raise concerns about, you know, private prisons as if, like, you know, that's some kind of particularly grave menace, and public prisons are kind of fine. And her work in this chapter and, you know, and part of a broader project, I think, is looking at the way that, you know, so-called Canada was created, which is huge land grants to corporations, you know, obviously the Hudson's Bay Company. And who is responsible for enforcing the law in those vast territories? It was corporations. And so when we see, you know, when pipeline companies are working really closely with the police, it's like, well, that's the history of this country, is that the police, one way of thinking about the police is that they are just a kind of enforcement arm for corporations. I think that analysis misses some things too, but it does show that it's not unusual for police and corporations to be linked. I also appreciate the chapter by Ryan Hayes entitled Let's Talk About Police in Our Unions, which is, I think, helpfully pointing out the ways that police departments have things that they call unions, but that obviously have never been part of the labor struggle except in opposition to it. And I think that, you know, we need to think about, first of all, like the enormous power of what I prefer to call police brotherhoods in so-called Canada and around the world. These are well-financed propaganda organizations, as well as rackets, as well as organizations that collect dirt on politicians and activists and use it in ways we sometimes know very little about, but can involve pressuring politicians to take decisions on their side. But ironically, a lot of labor unions actually will accept police brotherhoods as members. And if that didn't happen, that wouldn't solve everything. But clearly that's something that needs to happen, is that we need to stop having police brotherhoods as part of labor union umbrellas. So that, I think that chapter is really important.
Another part of the book that I'm very excited about are the chapters about social work. It's a very easy reaction when someone accepts that police are not a useful tool in many circumstances to then turn to social work as the alternative. But for those of us who have experienced various forms of incarceration and conflicts with the state, we know that social work as an institution is an extension of the carceral system, that social workers often are just the equivalent of police officers. Just instead of a gun, they have other tools that they use to control people. We know that youth apprehension is one of the main devices used for the continued genocide of Indigenous people. So to see social workers getting involved in the movement and questioning their profession and looking at changing that system, I think that's very interesting, and it gives me some hope that at some point we can avoid falling into the trap of defunding the police to then fund carceral social work, and that we can instead create better social services that are by and for communities, that respect people's rights, and that are about uplifting the entire community and respecting people's human rights.
I can briefly draw attention to Vicky Chartrand's chapter on grassroots justices. But I want to situate that in terms of the larger collection and what I think is its unique and powerful focus on what I would call, or what in the Freelance Free Peoples chapter we call, like, an anti-colonial orientation towards abolition. I do think that many of these chapters are focusing on the way that the carceral system, the penal system, operates as an arm of settler colonialism, specifically in relation to Indigenous peoples, and I think, and their removal from their lands. And I think that that is distinct from a lot of the work that, of course, all of us are informed by and draw on that's been done in the States, that I think has, you know, powerfully focused on the penal system as a continuation of slavery, and has focused, I would say, has taken more of an anti-racist analytical approach to abolition. I think we're doing something slightly different in this collection, and so I'm happy to see that analysis. I think Vicky Chartrand's chapter that looks at missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, and looks at the ways in which indigenous communities because, of course, those communities have never been served by police in the face of missing and murdered indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. Those communities have enacted their own forms of justice that, you know, continue, like I was saying earlier, that continue indigenous laws and justice traditions, and that enact new articulations of relational accountability. And so she talks about, you know, this project that she did, Unearthing Justices, which was a cross-country journey that she went on, where she spoke with countless indigenous organizers who were doing the work, like, you know, Drag the Red in Winnipeg, which was, you know, a community-driven initiative to look for indigenous women who had gone missing to drag the Red River. She talks about, you know, all of the various marches, storytelling that's happened in communities around the missing and murdered, and the way that they're remembered in community, honored in community, and that justice is enacted in many different ways. I think that's important when we come up against the question of, you know, abolition, is it possible? Is it this sort of naive desire for the future? Which, you know, those of us who are abolitionists always get those kinds of questions. But I think Vicky's chapter and other chapters in the book do a really good job of showing how people are creating and enacting justice, enacting abolitionist futures in the present. So I think abolitionists like to stress that abolition is not just sort of a future desire, but it's also an act in the present. And then, as I was pointing out earlier, it's also one of my comrades in Freelance Free Peoples like to say, in an Indigenous context, it's also about a remembering, otherwise a looking back to sort of prior practices that existed before the settler colonial state.
I'm wondering if you guys can talk a bit about what you're hoping this book will do once it's out in the world. Like, are there specific audiences you're hoping that it reaches? Are there specific conversations that you would really like to see be more widespread?
So I think this book has the potential to reach a really broad audience. I think for people that are directly affected by policing, this is the kind of book that is very validating, that can help think about ways to organize, but also just see that, you know, all the conversations that we have in community are actually being recorded and put out into the world. So I think it can be a very interesting thing for community members to read. I also think that it will be a great educational tool. I really hope that a lot of teachers will assign some of those readings to their students, that the general public would read this, that parents would read this with their kids. So I think it has a potential to be pretty broad in who it can target, because we all live in society where there's policing. And so everyone is either complicit of the system or resisting against it. So I hope that it will reach a lot of people. So I would encourage absolutely everyone to pick it up and read, and, you know, perhaps starting with the chapters that appeal to them the most and then working around that. And hopefully that will lead to people maybe joining existing coalitions, starting their own, and to better articulate also those demands when it comes to politicians, because we've seen that we had an initial successful response where the majority of Montrealers supported reducing the budget of the police. The city here in Montreal, you know, pushed back a lot and refused and actually responded with a lot of propaganda and a lot of increases in the police budget. So we're at risk of losing that momentum. And so this book can be one of the tools to regain it and to remind people why we want to defund the police, and the fact that there's a few shootings here and there, or that there's any other violence happening in the city, is actually more reason to want to move ahead with defunding the police and not the other way around. So I hope that it will be distributed quite widely.
I think, you know, one of the strengths of the book is that the chapters are really well written and thought through, but they're also really, really accessible. I think they're written in an everyday language, and the chapters are also pretty short. So it's not a huge undertaking to pick up the book and, you know, as Sandra said, start somewhere and see if you're inclined to read the whole book, and maybe you're not, which is also fine. And I think that it's really helpful that the book is coming out now in 2022, because, you know, defund the police was everywhere in the media in 2020. And if you're still part of the struggle, then you know that it hasn't gone away. Just because the media is not talking about it doesn't mean that people aren't organizing, etc. But I don't know, people who weren't already connected might not know that it's still going on. And this might be a way of tapping in and, you know, engaging with these ideas and then becoming part of the movement. So I think it serves an important role in maintaining an ongoing process of popular education at a time when the media's interest in this idea is very fickle, and so they've kind of moved on. I would want to give this book to people who express a concern about one aspect of the problem of policing. So sometimes I meet a lot of people who are concerned about racial profiling. Racial profiling, I think, is an easier thing for people to wrap their heads around as their first kind of critique of policing. There are others, but I think sometimes people think that you can stop racial profiling by doing some kind of little adjustment. And the book really shows you that, you know, your concern about racial profiling can be an entry into a more profound analysis, and then a political project that will take longer, but that will actually do something about this problem that you care about. And I think the same could be said for other entry points to concerns about policing, such as, you know, massive violence against homeless people, against drug users, against sex workers, etc. Whatever initiates your concern with policing, either because it affects you personally or because it affects people you know, or you feel in solidarity with in the city, I think the book can help connect you to other problems with the policing and help you to understand that there isn't some kind of little adjustment that can be made to the police that will stop these problems. Is that we actually need to defund the police on the route to abolishing it.
Another one of the unique features of the book, I think, is that it does combine, you know, activists, organizers, people with firsthand experience of criminalization and surveillance by police, as well as scholars and academics. And those categories are not mutually exclusive either. So I don't want to imply that they are. And there are many authors in the book who occupy many of those positions. So I think that's pretty unique. It's not an academic book per se. And I find that really important and refreshing and hopefully reflective of what the abolitionist movement is or can be, that we can all sort of bring our strengths and experiences to the table to inform the struggle. Also, I think just to maybe echo what Ted was saying in terms of the book really offering sort of an insight into the interconnectedness of the penal system and the interconnectedness of all of the different institutions that feed into the larger carceral culture. So we were talking about social work, policing, prisons. I think people have the tendency to sort of talk about police defunding. Maybe there's less comfort around talking about, or it seems to me there's less comfort talking about prison abolition. But I think that the collection does a good job of showing the interconnectedness of those systems. We can't talk about them in isolation from each other.
Abby, would you be able to tell people where they can get the book if they would like to get a copy?
So the publisher is BTL Books, Between the Lines Books. I mean, hopefully people will ask their local bookstore to order it in. That would be amazing in terms of supporting local bookstores. Phone your local bookstore and see if they provide it, not ask them to order it. But yeah, the BTL website is probably the place to start.
My last question is there anything that you all wanted to talk about that I didn't ask you about?
I appreciate that it has disarm, defund, dismantle, and abolition in the title. When you were asking who I hoped would read it, I was thinking, do I hope that you know, city councilors in Montreal read this book? And I don't really know. What I know is that no one currently on city council will claim to have read this book, because this language is not co-optable. And so I appreciate that, you know, it's not hiding a radical argument behind some kind of liberal language. It's not going to get watered down. This is a book that will serve real social transformation, and people who read it and understand it won't be confused about the fact that we're talking about, you know, a movement that will radically transform the society and not police reform, which is very easy to support. Pretty much everyone's in support of police reform, except abolitionists.
I just encourage everyone to read the book, but also to have their own reflections on the idea of defunding the police, and to take any issue in their community that people are organizing around. It can be in terms of domestic violence. It can be in terms of, you know, children's education, all those issues. I think it's worth it to take a moment and to filter them through the lens of police funding and reinvesting in community, and to see if that issue could be improved with those types of actions. And I think in most cases, the answer will be yes. I hope that that's what, you know, people will start doing as a methodology of analyzing things that happen in our society, to take a moment and to ask ourselves if defunding the police and reinvesting in something else would be helpful. And we didn't actually address, now that I'm mentioning it, in our chapter, we do talk quite a bit about domestic violence and sexual violence, and how it's often used as this gotcha when we're having conversations about police abolition or about decriminalization, about anti-carceral ideas. People always say, well, you know, what about when, you know, you're being raped, or what about domestic violence? You're going to be calling the cops when, you know, something happens to you. And I think that's one of the biggest fronts that we need to make more progress on, because once we're able to fully get the feminist movement on board with defunding the police, which they're slowly getting there, then we will take away one of the big barriers that prevents law reform from happening. I know from speaking to politicians all the time that they're so afraid that the feminist movement will accuse them of different things, that whenever we have movements where we're denouncing sexual violence, for example, well, the response of government is to just announce a bunch of funding for police and other carceral measures, because it's easy and it, you know, appeases the public. So I think that's one of the big areas where we need to keep working hard to change that mentality, and to show people that concerns about violence against women are not addressed through the carceral system. And once we achieve that, I think we'll be, you know, way further in our quest to creating the better world that we're dreaming about.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We wanted to share this message from the Certain Days Calendar Collective. It reads, "The Certain Days Collective will be releasing our 22nd calendar this coming autumn. In lieu of a theme for 2023, we're doing an open call for abolition-related art and article submissions to feature in the calendar, which hangs in more than 6,000 homes, workplaces, prison cells, and community spaces around the world. We encourage contributors to submit both new and existing work. We especially seek submissions from people in prison or jail, so please forward this call to any prison-based artists and writers. The deadline for submissions is Friday, June 14th, 2022. You can submit articles that are 400 to 500 words maximum. Poetry is also welcome, but it needs to be significantly shorter than 400 words in order to accommodate layout. Please include a suggested title for your piece. You can also submit art. The calendar is 11 inches tall by 8.5 inches wide, so art with a portrait orientation is preferred, but art does not need to fit those dimensions exactly. They are interested in a diversity of media, and the calendar is printed in color, and they prefer color images. If you would like to submit art or articles, you can email them at info@certaindays.org. Artists can send a low-res file as a submission, but if your piece is chosen, they would like a high-resolution version of it for print. People who are in prison can write to them at Certain Days, care of Burning Books, 420 Connecticut Street, Buffalo, New York, in the United States, and the zip code is 14213. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and prisonradioshow.libsyn.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Prison Radio Show. Parts of our show are also available through podcasting apps. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. Our next show will air on Friday, April 22nd at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you want to be involved in the show, feel free to contact us. Our email address is prison@ckut.ca. As I said before, we're available by phone if you want to call us collect from Bordeaux or RDP prisons. The number is 514-876-3748. We also have a regular phone line. If you do not need to call collect, you can call us at 438-337-8423. You can also send us mail. We are at the Prison Radio Show, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia, and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
Good evening, it's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy, recording from home on Thursday, April 7th, And we're going to do some things a little differently tonight. Waiting for many big theater productions to open up later this month, with shows from Black Theater Workshop, Centaur, Siegel, and Infinitheater, to name a few. And I'll take you behind the scenes of those productions over the next few weeks. But in the meantime, I've got some different kinds of arts goings on to share with you. I'll speak again with musician Norman Navratsky, who is organizing a fundraiser for relief efforts in Ukraine and Poland.
Many of us have not played for 2.5 years for good reasons, because of COVID. That we're coming together for this particular purpose kind of invests it with a special magic for us, that we know we're playing for an amazing cause.